Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we will be continuing this deep exploration of the future of spiritual practice with tonight's special guest, Lama Surya Das, the first Westerner to become a fully ordained Tibetan Buddhist Lama. Terry Patton is a visionary behind this groundbreaking series and online community and our host tonight. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who coaches, challenges, supports, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you, Paul. Hi, everybody. Welcome. I convened Beyond Awakening to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a really probing and deep public dialogue about how our spirituality can play a real role in helping us rise to the challenges of our time and make this transition that seems so elusive to a more sustainable and compassionate human presence on our planet. We face enormous ecological and engineering challenges, but the cultural and spiritual challenges are probably more fundamental and less well understood. So that's our focus here. And we've had a whole series of really probing, enlivening, and adventuresome conversations in which we focused on many specific aspects of this question. And tonight, I'm really happy to be joined in conversation by Lama Surya Das in a dialogue entitled, A Spirituality That Can Create the Future. Surya Das is one of today's foremost Western Buddhist meditation teachers and scholars, and a leading spokesperson for emerging American Buddhism. The Dalai Lama affectionately calls him the Western Lama. While a college student, he attended anti-war protests, marched on Washington, and attended Woodstock. And then he spent the next years, almost 40 years, studying spirituality, Zen, Vipassana, yoga, and Tibetan Buddhism with the great masters of Asia, including the Dalai Lama's own teachers. He has twice completed the traditional three-year meditation cloistered retreat at his teacher's Tibetan monastery. Now, he lives an active life in the United States, and he's involved in interfaith dialogue, social activism, and he's a very sought-after speaker. He teaches, he lectures, he conducts retreats around the world. He's appeared in major media all over the place. He's a published poet and a translator, and is the author of many books, including Awakening the Buddha Within, The Mind is Mightier Than the Sword, Buddha Is as Buddha Does, and Letting Go of the Person You Used to Be. When he's not on the road, he lives and teaches in Concord, Massachusetts, through his nonprofit, the Dzogchen Foundation. Speaking personally, I want to say that one of the things I love about Surya Das is his unique blend of spacious awareness and down-to-earth humor, which among other things, makes him the trustable heart and human being, and also somebody who, among contemporary spiritual teachers, could, with reasonable veracity, be called the king of the one-liners. It's a real delight to welcome you, Surya Das.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's wonderful to be here, and this is a great initiative. So,
well,
buckle up, everyone.
Yeah. You know, Surya Das, there's this age-old debate between activists and spiritual practitioners, and it's kind of a chicken-egg debate. Which comes first, our own transformation or our service to the world? And this paradox goes back all the way to ancient times, and yet a lot of folks are now saying that we need to consider it in new terms because our spirituality is informed by a new kind of discernment with scientific insights and also because we're facing new global challenges with tremendous urgency, and we can't afford to be patient for generations at this time. And we need to be heroic activists right now in a whole new way. How would you respond to that? How do you think it's shifted? How is it the same? What lights up in your heart as you feel into that?
Well, I think it's too linear to say which comes first. You know, what comes first, breathing in or breathing out? And I think being and doing emerge together. From one point of view, we could say being is primary, whether we're doing anything not or just being still, just being. But really, it emerges together. It's like being alone and being with others. We're all alone here together. And I don't see it as that linear. It's more cyclical or more holistic, more total. But I do think it's important to recognize, Terry, that if we're going to talk about the future of spirituality or even the present, which is the timeless future, includes the past and everything, really we have to think about a global spirituality, not just the different religions with their isms and schisms, but really a spirituality for our time, timeless wisdom for today and tomorrow, something that's really helpful and sane and helps us to be all that we are and can be. Like we say in the Dzogchen tradition of Tibet, Tibetan mysticism, non-dual mysticism, we're all Buddhas by nature, not Buddhists, God forbid. We're all Buddhas by nature. We only have to awaken to that fact. So we can awaken from the inside out through contemplative practices. We can awaken from the outside in through good works and service, karma, yoga, compassion and action, and so forth. And really these go together like breathing in and breathing out. Some parts of our life more emphasizing one, some parts emphasizing another more. Some parts of the day, some passages, some decades of our life more involved in one or the other. I was in retreat in Tibetan monasteries for many years, and now I'm a wandering Dharma teacher and social spiritual activist. There's no contradiction. It's like my teaching and writing is a seamless whole with my prayer life and meditation, and even talking tonight in this new media on the internet. So I think what's important is the heart of it all, where we're coming from, the intention, the motivation. I'd like to uplift us all together.
And that's been true, really, anciently. Everything you said is a kind of timeless truth. And that one might infer from what you said, maybe not accurately, I'm not sure, that your sense is that eternal spiritual truth is the main point, and that the things that are new and unique that are just emerging now are maybe not as much the point as that more timeless set of principles, and that even though we have special urgencies that are unique to our time, the main point is to wake up to that which doesn't change.
Yes, that's the main point, or a main point. That's one side of the main point. The other side is really to ride the cusp of the wave, which is changing every moment. So it's not either or again. I think it's both and. And I differ with this with some of my friends, like Andrew Cohen, who we had a dialogue last night at the Tibetan Rubin Museum in New York. And he was talking about evolutionary enlightenment. And I said, that's fine, but it sounds a little linear to me. I think there's a part that really is beyond time, and it's always now, and it's the timeless, inexpressible, or whatever we want to call it, Dharmakaya, or the totally and wholly now. It's beyond past, present, and future. It's the fourth time, as we say in Tibetan, the fourth fraction. It's the timeless time. It's the holy now. So I think it's a combination, Terry, of being in time but also not of it or embracing it all. If we can let go into that timeless zone or flow or just being even now, it will embrace and uphold us. There's no problem. But we're afraid to let go. So we keep staggering forward on the treadmill of events under the momentum of our conditioning. But when we can stop and drop even for a moment, one moment of total awareness is one moment of freedom and enlightenment, as it says in the Dzogchen tradition. If we can stop and drop into awareness right now, it's all there, it's all within, it's all here.
So in the spirit of really doing that and taking that fully seriously, would you like to take a moment to just expand on that and offer us a transmission of that? timeless being, stopping.
Well, everything I've been saying is that, and everything is that, the alarm clock of reality is always going off. When are we going to take the pillows off our ears and wake up?
Mm.
And how long does it take? friends, how many lifetimes of schlepping to enlightenment or heaven or whatever we call it? How many years, how many hours, how many lifetimes to wake up? Thus, throughout time, there's been a kind of friendly debate about whether enlightenment is sudden or gradual. But as we say, if you hit a rock 99 times with a hammer and the 100th time it breaks open suddenly, is that sudden or gradual? So I think that the experience is beyond time and in the moment and totally fresh. And if you have one moment, one glimpse, it changes your life forever. And at the same time, it gets better and better. Like good wine matures by being left in the bottle and gets better year by year. It gets more stable. It gets richer. And I think that our wisdom, the endangered natural resource of innate wisdom, that is an endangered natural resource in this world. That endangered natural resource, if we can wake up to it and develop it, stabilize it and realize it within ourselves and each other, it will get better year by year. And that's the evolutionary enlightenment, I think. And it's not that there's nothing new. It's that everything is new every moment. And there's nothing new about that. So, yes, I do think we live in very vital times. For example, with environmental degradation, with nuclear armaments, we could blow ourselves off the planet. But I'm not sure that this time is different, really, in quality of life than other times. Of course, we have a longer lifespan. We have instant communications and travel. But today, all these leisure-saving devices and modern devices that are supposed to provide us with more leisure and ease and time, we somehow, paradoxically enough, people are time-stressed, time-fatigued. We seem to be in a time famine. But I personally feel that we have all the time in the world. It's just focus and awareness that we lack. There's 64 million mind moments in a second, they say. There's so much space between our thoughts. There's so much room for awareness. The more present we are, the more attentive we are, the more intentional we can be. It's now or never, as always. This is very important, I think, to wake up to. It's not time we lack, but focus and awareness. And then we can be masters rather than victims of conditions and circumstances. And realize it's not what happens to us, but what we make of it that makes all the difference. And then we have our hands on the steering wheel of our lives, and we can recognize cause and effect a better world. There's no doubt about that. We have to do that together. Nobody can do it alone. So I think the bodhisattva ethic or the altruistic awakener, the bodhisattva, the spiritual warrior, as Trungpa Rinpoche loosely translated it, the edifier, the awakener, is a really good model or archetype for us today, combining fearless courage and joyous effort, along with centered, discriminating wisdom, patient forbearance, ethical discipline, and so forth, all the panacean virtues that help us to be there even while we're getting there. Being there while getting there, that's the transmission for today, Terry. Being right here, being there while getting there, not waiting to get there. Being there while getting there, then every step of the way to heaven is heaven, as the mystics have said. And I firmly believe that, and I think that's part of what we could be doing together tonight, even now, in this medium. We can have a mind-to-mind, heart-to-heart encounter, even if it's not FaceTime. It could be mind-to-mind, heart-to-heart time, yes. Spiritual resuscitation, yes. That's my intention.
Oh, beautiful. And in deepening into that, we're deepening into this being that is also becoming, this beginner's mind, ever new, eternal, always changing, never changing, dying, being born. And a sense of wonder is mainly what arises for me, a kind of presence of something I can't even put my finger on that just delights my heart, a sense of grace, a sense of...
Well, you got it. it's wonderment, and it's wonderful, and it's fullness. It's the fullness of emptiness. It's not a particular thing. It's everything. It's the fertile womb of emptiness. It's shining. It's warm. It's all-encompassing. That's why I was mentioning letting go and yet being held at the same time, not throwing things away, not abandoning ourselves except in the deepest sense, but a real letting go and letting be, a radical acceptance and trust can help bring about an incredible feeling of being held, of being embraced, of uplift, of buoyancy. And that's the spiritual wind. That's the spiritual current. That's the flow of which we're all part, that we're never apart from. The true path from which we can never stray, which is right beneath our feet always. We may feel far from it, however we call it, the absolute it, but it's never far from us, I assure you. And we don't have to build bridges to cross over that flow or get to the other side or get into the flow, Joe. It's flowing through us right now, the great Tao, flowing through us every moment. We're all expressions of it. If there is an evolution, that's part of the timeless, changeless continuum. Just like the species evolve, and yet evolution sort of remains. So it's not just so linear as we would think, going from here to there or getting better. Some people ask me if we're all going to be enlightened or at heaven at the end. That's a little limited. I'm sure that heaven or enlightenment is not exactly what we think it is in our conceptual framework. But I'm equally sure as one glimpse, one moment of illumination illumines the darkness of eons, and we're never the same again.
There are so many different dimensions implicit. It's like we're standing in the center of a thousand-petaled lotus or a thousand-faceted gem. And in this place, we can go a lot of different places. One of the places that we have gone, and that I think a lot of our listeners are interested in, though, you've kind of crisscrossed this territory of evolution. And I stressed evolution in my introduction to the event because I do find it breathtakingly beautiful that this whole process that is our most hard-headed materialist scientists are telling us the nature of it all is now being discovered to be, in essence, a single trajectory, always getting more complex and conscious and interconnected and cooperative and becoming self-aware right now. It's almost like that story says that if you leave primordial stuff, hydrogen and helium, alone long enough, they eventually become all the bacteria and plants and animals and
they did
and write
they have
symphonies and
it
build
is
cathedrals and put and put
yes
telescopes into orbit and wonder at the meaning of it all and laugh and cry and delight and intend as we are here right now.
It's like the 100 monkeys allegory. You know, they used to say if 100 monkeys were typing on a typewriter, some of them would produce Shakespeare's Hamlet. Of course, that was kind of facetious. But what it really means is that you put 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 monkeys together, and eventually you have Homo sapiens, not just monkeys. It's happened.
And there is a kind of meaning in that, isn't there? That 13.7 billion years of this process leading to a certain place, it's that we stand as it right now, it leaves me intending, evolution wants to keep evolving, and consciousness wants to keep unfolding. It's like the flower wants to keep blooming.
Yes, I think there's a spiritual tropism at work, like a flower, the green flowers, the chlorophyll-based plants reach for the light,
yeah,
and the spirit, the spiritual mind, the chitta, as we call it in Sanskrit, whatever, consciousness, if you like, is reaching for the light also. If I say it's reaching up, that seems too dualistic. It's reaching out. It's growing. It's enriching. It's evolving naturally. And that's part of the buoyancy or uplift of spirit. Enlightenment or transcendental wisdom awareness is not static. It's ecstatic. It's buoyant. It's joyful. It's joyous. When you were talking about evolution, and you asked me to be on this in this part of this discussion a while ago, and you called it Beyond Awakening, and I was thinking, what is Beyond Awakening? Oh, that's provocative. I'll have to think about that. And I was thinking, yeah, Beyond Awakening is awakeness, is awakefulness.
Right.
And awakening is like the evolutionary process.
Mm.
It's a gerund. But awakefulness is in the Dharmakaya and Buddha mind, nothing happens.
Mm.
And everything just goes on at the same time. It's not oblivion.
Right.
It's the creative, you know, it's a divine dance. It's like Sheila's Maya Leela, the divine dance of magical illusion. It's not that it's just illusion, it's magical illusion, it's divine. We're all God's pseudopods, to talk theism. We're all appendages of that. There's nothing missing. We're like the Muppets, but there's the one single, you know, this is just finger painting here, not theology. One single hand inside the Muppet with its the different heads and different fingers of each of us.
Right.
Which brings us back always to the question of who are we? Who am I? What is our true nature? What is the relation of God and human, to talk Western? What is the self? What is our true nature, to talk Eastern? What's the relation in the one and the many? And the wholeness, the one in the many, and all in the one. The interwoven net of interbeing, the great net of being. That's us.
And,
Buddhas are us, and not Buddhist Buddhas. This earth is like an altar, and we're all like the deities walking on it. But can we see that in each other? Would that we could. Then we would treat others like the Golden Rule says, treat others as you yourself would be treated. Well, I think we need to evolve that statement, because we treat ourselves like shit so much of the time. Treat others as you would have your beloved child be treated. That should be the new platinum rule.
Or your beloved divine,
yes.
Most cherished,
exactly.
Loved one.
Beloved, whoever it is.
Mm. Well, you know, it all comes
down to love in the end, no matter how much we wax philosophical.
It does, yeah. And love in action at a time,
yeah.
Right now when it seems
love is
that,
a verb. Love is action.
Yes.
Love comes through loving, not from outside. There's no love out there. Go and collect some. Bring me some. Love comes through loving. And there's so many kinds of love. We haven't really studied this subject, although there are so many songs about it. You know, there's everything from youthful lust and, oh, I'm in lust with her. You know, crushes, infatuation, and then there's more adult love and committed love, and there's parental love and filial love and sibling love, and there's also divine love or devotional love of the divine, of the higher truth, of the bigger, the transcendental, the transpersonal being, not just our personal being. And there's self-love, there's, you know, there's mating, married love, there's a lot of different kinds of love. We've hardly begun to touch the depths of it. It would be a good study for us. What is wisdom? What is love? Truth and love. Truth without love or compassion is blind. And love without truth is it's fickle. It's treacly. It's lost. Love without wisdom is lost, is fickle.
Mm. Yeah, well, true love.
Truth without
is
love
fierce,
is sterile.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Wisdom and compassion go together like the two wings of a bird, truth and love in Judeo-Christianity, wisdom and compassion in Buddhism, two wings of a bird. Bird needs both wings to fly, and we need the awakened eyes of wisdom and truth. I'm not saying a truth, I'm saying clear seeing, clear vision. When I becomes clear, everything becomes clearer. That's wisdom for today. And the heart of compassion and love and empathy, feeling with others, feeling what others feel and being moved to help. That's compassion in action. The marriage of head and heart is heaven and earth joined in ourselves, in our lives. And then everything we do becomes meaningful, not just mistaking via movement for meaning, not just so-called progress. You know, sometimes we have more quantity and not more quality of life, as everybody knows, but who really understands and can change on that basis. We all say we want to change, but who's ready, willing, and able to change? It's a challenge to face the unknown, to make the mistakes, and to persist and go on, to persevere. And who's able to change? Who knows how? Who has the means and methods? It's a challenge. We have to be ready, willing, and able to change, not just affirm, I want to change, I'm changing.
You know, Surya Das, this getting real, you know, there's a ferocity and a fire kind of burning behind those questions and that forging forth that you're doing in all this. And it's really very much of the same spirit that I was in when I conceived this series. And I really wanted to ask some tough questions along the lines of the questions that you may have seen this book that James Hillman wrote 15 or so years ago called We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse.
I did. I thought the title was enough, said it all.
Yeah. Well, in it, you know, what Hillman was basically wondering is our work on ourselves distracting us from our outer work to change the world, or are we going into therapy or doing our inner work as an alternative to doing our outer service? And as we reach a moment in which an awful lot of folks are afraid that we're passing some terrible point of no return in terms of environmental or other degradation, and it seems that we desperately need to bring a different level of wisdom and compassion and commitment and focus to human life, that our spirituality, you know, I certainly went into the path, and I think you did too, with the sense that we were facing problems that couldn't be solved with the kind of consciousness that had created them, and we really hoped to wake into a consciousness that could be part of that solution, and at this time, our generation has inherited this world, and yet the problems seem only more intractable in many ways, and so it seems like our spirituality needs to be participating in this human world, and with a kind of leadership that can cut through. And even though the eternal truths are the eternal truths, isn't there something new that can happen in our time that can cut through at some new level? And I really wanted to stand with some deep brothers like yourself and sisters in this consideration, people who've given their lives to these kind of considerations, who really care about them, and ask these hard questions that we maybe even don't have good enough answers for, you know, but to live those questions, like Rilke said,
yeah.
Living the question, like a Zen monk holding a koan, like just leaning into these hard questions and insisting on better answers.
I think that's a very good question, and I don't know if there's something different we can do, but I think we have to try. We have to try to find a way, because who knows? We may be coming to the end times, environmentally or for other reasons, or pandemics or nuclear holocaust. And who knows? You know, we're overpopulation and extinction. Who knows? But I think it's incumbent upon those of us who feel moved to do so to really become the wise elders or the visionaries or the antenna of the race. And I'm not saying egotistically. I mean, the chosen people are those who choose themselves. So you know, link arms. That's the chosen choose themselves. So join up. Circle the wagons. We'll do this together. We're doing this together.
Yeah.
And I don't know but I think we have to find a way. And we're from the boomer generation, the 60s and all, and like Hillman, and we were very much part of the consciousness movement. Of course, we were all socially activists. Again, in the Vietnam War movement, peace movement, civil rights, women's rights, and so on. But I think that was really a movement towards individual consciousness raising. And I think now we have to think a bit more about collective consciousness. Maybe that's the difference. If it is collective consciousness, doing this together, we can, you know, that we're all autonomous but interdependent. Interdependence has become such a profound understanding today, not just in the global economy and communications, but in so many ways how we're interdependent, and that has profound ramifications and implications on in every level outer and inner and deepest ultimate. So maybe that's an area that we could be plumbing and rooting around in and kind of blindly guddling around, as they say in Scotland, the guddling under the stream for the fish with your hands, kind of groping around in the dark, in the mystery, in the not knowing, for not just the inner work or the outer work, but a third way, a fourth way, maybe the integral way, is it something that encompasses both. But I think this is something people, this is a timeless evergreen koan or conundrum, Terry, that people have been grappling forever. Martha and Mary in the Bible, the one who gets it by faith and the one who gets it by deeds. There have been many movements throughout history divided along those lines. Anyway, I think that the Bodhisattva ideal that I've mentioned is a good one because it includes contemplation and action, and it's a very spiritual activist means of being an awakener, awakening yourself while awakening the world, not waiting to get enlightened, as some people say. How can you help until you've helped yourself? Well, help yourself, man, and help everyone at the same time. Don't just try to rearrange the deck chairs on the, your deck, your berth on the Titanic. That's going down. So I think that this is an opportunity for us today to do this together. Also, I want to say, as Margaret Mead famously did, it's always been a small number of committed and dedicated people who have changed the world. So we can be like the yeast that leavens and raises the whole loaf of bread. And it's not democracy rules in the spiritual world. Even to save one soul is to save the whole world, as the Talmud says. So when we awake up, the whole world is awakened. That's just, they say, how it is. And I'll second that. But of course, this is something we must explore for ourselves to keep it real and make it real and become the wise elders that this world is crying out for. I think that's one practical way. And I think, out of this talk, I'd like to talk practical a little bit. And one practical thing is that we help each other to still be standing in 10, 20, or 30 years, standing together, so we can be wise elders for the next generations. In this over-information age, we think so much, we seem to know so much, but we understand so little. We really are crying out for wise elders, wise leaders, spiritual leaders, if you like, not just leaders of political organizations called churches that definitely have political agendas, but something more deeply in the spirit.
Yeah, this is so resonant.
Yeah, global spirituality, awakened consciousness. I don't know what it will be called. Maybe it'll be different than anything we've seen yet. I don't know.
One of the ideas that I've brought forward in some of the earlier dialogues is the idea that in some sense a new sangha of sanghas may be in the process of emerging, and a sangha of teachers in which we can, because, in the old model, once someone had, this is very much the case in the Hindu model. I think maybe there are some different patterns with Buddhism, but often the teacher, once the guru became the guru, they were hanging out with their students and maybe there were some peers, but that dynamic of accountability of the spiritual teacher, so that the spiritual teachers could be in a process that kept them growing.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed like something that was a necessary and inherent aspect of our current cultural zeitgeist that might change something about the spiritual path, and that maybe there could be some robust clarities and awakened understandings that were so strong that they could hold different spiritual sanghas together. We might have our own path that's a little different from somebody else's path, but all of us agree about certain fundamentals, and those agreements are so strong that they can hold us together, even though we might have some vigorous debate about some stuff we disagree about.
Yes, and I fully believe that. And that's the kind of global spirituality or even just local community that I'm working for and working on, not just my centers and my Dzogchen centers and Buddhist centers, but sort of light circles as I see it, that the centers are like light towers, but light circles of like-minded people. so that a new spirituality is possible. Even the Dalai Lama, who's so entrenched in Buddhism, even though he's universal, he's a Buddhist monk. I mean, you know, he's far from being any kind of New Age guru, whatever people think. He said that we must find us, all of us together, a new spirituality, a new concept that could be elaborated alongside the religions in such a way that all people of goodwill could adhere to it, and to something that we could contribute with to others, not just convert others with, to contribute, not to convert. And I think this is some of the kind of slogans or precepts, if you will, of a new global spirituality. And it doesn't have to be like Esperanto, where it's all mixed together and nobody wants to use it, you know, the language Esperanto. I think it's something very practical, beyond non-sectarian. It's kind of trans-conceptual, something that people can relate to, just like everybody relates to the happiness movement today, because everybody wants happiness, even if they call it something more fancy, like purpose or meaning or truth and love. So I think the happiness movement is not a bad example. It may not be the deepest, but it's something. Just like all the yoga studios around the country, some of them are just exercise, but it's a good Dharma gate. It's something, and there's a lot of spirituality in it. A lot of people are coming to deeper spirituality and the real meaning of yoga, union, and so on. Through yoga at the YMCA, yoga at the health spa, yoga in the office building, and so on. So I'm all for it. However it manifests, it's all part of the mandala of being, the radiant effulgence of the divine dance, of the Buddha nature, the divine dance of Shiva, if you like. No words can encompass it. By whatever name we call it, it still is sweet. The divine dance, I like that. And we could dance with life. We don't have to be so damn serious about it. Religions are intimidating with their intense seriosity and dogmatic extreme views, becoming part of the problem today instead of part of the solution. So I think the joy in not taking ourselves so seriously could be a big part of this global spirituality.
Well, it was interesting. You said some things that most people would respond to with an awful lot of seriousness. You know, the potential that we could be at end times is pretty sobering,
mm-hmm.
kind of a image. And yet you're also calling for a kind of lightheartedness. How does that work inside your being? Like, how do you work with the parts of yourself that look at some of these really difficult trends and get heavy and in some ways very, very sober and really, you know, you take that to heart and it's big stuff. And on the other hand, you've touched this, you know, utterly freeing lightness and humor, and that's really the nature of your realization. How do those coexist in your heart and your life?
Well, I'm schizophrenic, you know. There's Lama Surya Das, Sirius, and then there's kind of Sirius Das, you know, Jeffrey Miller from Long Island, Jokey, and we coexist, but actually I have more names and more selves, just like you do, and I contain multitudes, like Walt Whitman said, and we each do. So there's no one fixed self or way to be. I think the freer you become in heart, mind, and spirit, then the less you fixate anywhere or stand anywhere. You can dance in space and enjoy everything, if you like. It doesn't mean everything is good, but everything is what it is. That's hard to deny, and we can work with it. And that's Buddhist wisdom. To see wisdom is to see things as they are, not as necessarily as we would like them to be. Once we diagnose it as it is, then we can start to change it, perhaps for the better. It's not just a call for complacence and indifference. Radical acceptance is transformative. It doesn't just mean complacence and indifference.
Yeah. In fact, that radical...
I feel like the buoyant uplift of spirit from my own practice, from meditation and chanting and yoga and prayer and some philosophy, self-inquiry, and also from Sangha practice, being with kindred spirits on the way, is really the joy of my life. That's the jewel in the lotus for me, is community, is spiritual family, teachers and spiritual friends alike.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of joy and love in that and magic, far beyond my rational New York motor mind or anything I could have imagined. So that helps me keep in light. If we take ourselves too seriously, it ain't much fun.
You know, it's interesting how lit up I come to feel in my fierce, serious commitment, that there's a kind of letting it all hang out, kind of just ragged going for it, that is, it's like being, I don't know, ecstatic and high, you know, just to be so committed. For me, my commitment to serve liberates my energy, kind of cleans out my pipes and wakes me up and lets me feel a kind of humorous. When I feel like the larger will of this process is making good use of me, there's a kind of ecstasy in that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. There's an unadulterated joy in it, and you're not really prey to the small self and its vexations and perorations, like a chitching upon itself. Oh, what is the meaning of my life? And these other fallacious questions. And, you know, you really get on with it, and you create your own wake. You magnetize the field. You rule your world, as one Lama says. That's a little male dominant for me, but it's not bad at some point. You know, some people are a little spineless or victimized. It wouldn't be bad if they learned a little more to be self-masterful and rule their world. It doesn't mean rule others. To know others is mere knowledge. To know oneself is wisdom and enlightenment. So that's what ruling one's world means.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you bring that up, adjacent issue that sometimes surfaces comes to mind, and I wonder if you have anything to say about it. One of the things that I've seen debated among some of the more conscious spiritual progressives is the idea that this recording is taking place a few weeks after the 2010 midterm elections, in which Republicans won a lot of seats, and
yes.
some progressives were upset with President Obama, feeling that he wasn't willing to fight to be partisan enough, that in his attempt to kind of rise above the mere partisanship, he didn't fight as hard as he could. He didn't tend to create the clarion call for his values, and that I think that there is a side of this that shows up in terms of spiritual activism. Is our spiritual activism so much about transcending polarization that it becomes at times ineffectual? How does our commitment coincide with our freedom and our transcendence of local motives?
Well, I think we shouldn't get confused by conflating all the different levels and stages and dimensions. Spiritual activism, you know, is a little different than just political activism. It has a more timeless or long-term picture, muchly included, not just, you know, short-term success or election or gratification.
Right.
I'm a great fan of the president, but I also know that, you know, no one can fix it. The system has to change. No one individual can fix it in a few years. The entrenched lobbies and partisanship and all that. And in the recent election, one thing that dismayed me was the incredible loss of diversity. I think there's not going to be one black senator anymore, for the time being at least. But besides that, the bodhisattva ethic, or being a strong spiritual warrior, having the intention to awaken, illumine the world, be a light bearer, a bodhisattva, an awakener, serve the highest interest, the greatest good, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number and all, is a really long-term project. And we do what we can. Everything matters. It matters whether you kiss or kick your kid here and now, not just how screwed up they'll be later. Everything we do counts, and it's connected to other things long term and conditioning. You know, an action becomes a pattern, then it becomes a habit, then it becomes conditioning, and then it carries on for a long time and even goes down the generations. So I think it's important to be very conscious about causation, origins, and future implications, not just now and the short term results. There's no reason to say you always have to be moderate. Buddhism is called the middle way. Buddha never taught Buddhism. He called it the middle way, beyond extremes. But that doesn't mean you have to be extremely moderate all the time. There's a lot of lanes in the highway of enlightenment. just don't get stuck in the ditches on either side, like nihilism on one side, nothing matters, or substantial materialism on the other side. So I think the middle way would also be an extreme. If you see it, as you always have to be moderate. You know, like on New Year's Eve or on Saturday night, maybe you can be a little less moderate than the rest during the rest on school nights during the rest of the week, just as an example. So I don't think there's any call for having to fix on one anyone's strategy, but the sort of spiritual doctrine of upaya, or skillful means, resourcefulness, appropriate to causes and conditions, is very important. So we don't get stuck with any one way of being. Like Gerard Depardieu said in that really amusing, silly movie, Green Card, the problem with you is you're always left wing. You only have one wing. How can you fly? And I don't think we need to fall into that either. That's like being a pacifist, a passive instead of a pacifist. We shouldn't mistake mere quiet or stillness for great peace, nirvana. Great peace is beyond the polarities of noisy and quiet. An inner stillness, great stillness, resting at the origin of all things, the Alpha and Omega of all things, just resting there, is beyond the polarities of movement or non-action. The great spiritual work is beyond action and inaction. The flow isn't striving, and it's also not static. That's a mystery that we can live into. Like mm-hmm. you said, live that question, live into.
Well, you know, in that profundity of the non-dual, the way that's lived is a such a passionate force. The truly amazingly awakened beings who've changed my life and your life, these are not plain vanilla homogenized people whose
that's right.
individuality or whose character has been kind of just smoothed off. By you know, they're lions. They're ferocious
yeah.
and intense and passionate, joyous,
and outrageous,
celebrating
and
human
iconoclastic.
Beings.
They're not all diplomatic like the Dalai Lama. Some are very outrageous, iconoclastic, and provocative and challenging. And they thrive on chaos. One of them said, shake the tree of truth. Whatever falls and splinters off should. That's not it.
Well,
the truth can't be harmed.
Is that what we're called to right now? I mean, if we're in a time of crisis, is there a way in which we're called to come into our expression, to become the lions that the, you know, the kind of the kitten inside, you know, the inner kitten needs to kind of wake up into his whole leonine intensity so that we can rise to this moment? And how do people do that without becoming and maybe imbalanced and maybe doing damage?
Well, it's risky, and that's why it's hard to say, you know, unequivocally yes. It's risky, but those of us who are up to challenge, I think it's incumbent upon us to make that leap. You know, like, I don't know if kittens become lions or they become ligers or they become tigers, but let me suggest even further than that, we become more like a dragon or like a phoenix arisen from the ashes. That would be more of a tantric metaphor, from the ashes, you know, soaring up, fully grown, sudden awakening, and stepping out, stepping up to the next level, as we call it in Dzogchen. From the view of things as they are comes the meditation of seeing it as it is, leaving it as it is. And from that comes action, view, meditation, and action of the innate great perfection, the natural great consummation. Action, conduct, compassionate action. And even beyond that, after the action, there's Bokden, enhancement, taking it to the next step, breaking out like the Hulk, breaking out of his clothes, not just being a Buddha. Breaking out of that, even the rainbow body of limitless enlightened activity, in which there's no enlightened person or being, there's just enlightened activity. That's the challenge. That's the phoenix or the Garuda arisen from the ashes of this world and what's going on. And I think that's, you know, something very potent. That's kind of a potent metaphor or image that we could look into. Not just very gradual and slow and steady and safe. Although in general, for most people, that is important, and that's the way. Still, for mystics, for poets, for bhaktis and devotees, for those who like Rumi and St. John of the Cross and Milarepa of Tibet and St. Francis of Assisi. That's the way of rocket fuel, not just of not tipping over the apple cart as it's trundling quietly down the street. But you can get burned by rocket fuel if you don't know how to ride, you know, ride it, and if you don't know how to transmute the base metal or lead of our human nature into the gold of Buddha nature. It is a tantric transmutation. It's not for everybody. Swooping down from above. Most people need to climb up the spiritual path or mountain as if from below.
We have to know ourselves.
So Socrates said, but as you know, as James Hillman was saying, you know, 2,000 years of Western philosophy and we still don't know ourselves. That's why I don't jump to quick conclusions, Terry. You're asking me, do we have to do this or that? Now, maybe it's the time to take a breath and step back and reflect a little before we jump into a new century or millennia of more bloodshed and more mishigas, craziness, mishmash, having revolutions and turning around and ending up back where we started.
Where is your greatest clarity and where is your greatest not knowing as you look at all this? I mean, to some degree, you have a moral obligation as a teacher, as somebody who's given his life to Dharma, who has students to be a force for this awakening and this opening and this loving and this freedom that your whole life has been devoted to. And obviously it matters in some ways, matters in eternal ways that are well studied through your time in the Dharma path, but in other ways are new and showing up in unique moments. We're always tested. How you know, where help me understand both the certainties and the questions that live right here, right now.
Well, if I have any clarity, I would say it's in my meditation practice or in my bodhisattva vow that I affirm daily to help uplift all together, spiritually or in the light of enlightenment, let's say. And that's clear to me, and that's a mission, that's a purpose, that's a raison d'être, reason for being of my life.
Yeah.
And also to repay my gurus and teachers for all that they've given me, this timeless treasure trove of ancient wisdom and inner technology for awakening,
mm-hmm.
and to uphold that lineage and pass it on to others, the next generation, and keep it alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a certainty.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of uncertainty about adapting and innovating and how to be most effective and, you know, not burn out,
mm-hmm.
not dilute the message just for convenience or success and popularity, how to be most transformative and effective.
The upaya.
The upaya, the skillful means, the question I'm always thinking about. Before you mentioned very intelligently, I think, the need for teacher sanghas, not just for congregations of seekers. And
right.
Among Buddhist teachers, we try to do that, and we have teachers' council every year. Like sometimes with the Dalai Lama and other spiritual leaders.
Mm-hmm.
The next big one is for 6 days at Garrison Institute that some of us are organizing next June for a few hundred Buddhist teachers, including 40 or 50 of the pioneering ones who've been teaching since the 60s and 70s and 80s, if they're still alive. So I found that the mirror in which to see these, myself and my work in these things more clearly that my gurus and teachers provided me in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s is in a way no more clear or sharp than the mirror in which my peers and colleagues provide me that perspective and clarity and sharing today.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what Thich Nhat Hanh said, who's a brilliant teacher and inspiration to us all, the Vietnamese Zen master and peace activist and poet. He said, the Buddha Maitreya of the future, the one who's supposed to be coming in the future, is not one 7-foot-tall person. It's the Sangha. It's the community. So I think that's all of us. That brings a very leveling effect. I think we have to really see the wisdom in each other and bring it forth, and not just wait for one more savior or messiah, even if it's called the Buddha of the future.
Beautiful. Yeah, I've been reflecting on how much our vulnerability, how big a role that plays, our willingness to be seen as imperfect beings with an unlimited, eternal intuition of perfection, and how letting the vulnerability of our divine and human, you know, dual nature be, you know, just letting it hang out so that we can engage and touch and have a different level of contact. That maybe Sangha is a kind of, the next level of Sangha might be a level of intimacy that's closer to the kind of thing that we think of existing between lovers, where there's deep willingness to be seen and to see into the heart of that other person.
Yes. Not just Sangha, like belonging to a group or a congregation, but that level of intimacy, I, thou, yes.
Yeah. Because we can trust each other in a different way, and if we have a commitment to something greater than ourselves, and we're really sincerely trying to give ourselves to that, but not perfectly, and we're willing to be seen in the complexity of that, and we share those values, and we're doing that sometimes heroically and sometimes, you know, imperfectly, and the whole kind of beautiful, terrible human affair of living that out, and sometimes slipping and falling, and sometimes being amazing and doing great things is just there. There's a richness of shared experience, a cheering of each other on and a picking of each other up when we fall, and a forgiving, and a, you know, like where the shame gets just purified out of the system, and that the coherence, the standing wave of us together, has a different kind of yeast in it than has tended to be the case in human gatherings up until now.
Yes, well, that's beautiful, all that you said, and I think we really need to, you know, all of that comes into the category of what I would call love as a verb, and really, you know, practicing, like, relational mindfulness, loving kindness in action with each other, not just as an abstraction, and not just giving charity out of pity, but compassion means empathizing, feeling what others feel, and treating them like you would treat yourself. Like when your children are sick, you wish you could jump into their hospital bed and so they could and take the disease on so they could run out and play. That's real brotherhood, a sisterhood, or charity, a royal giving, giving of oneself, not just giving of material things, and really seeing the light in others, and that others are as important and want and need the same as we do. And that we really can't be all that we are and must be. Let me talk Buddhism. We can't be enlightened. We can't be awakened without others, because it needs compassion, not just wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday I had lunch with a Catholic priest, Michael Holleran in New York, who's also a Zen master in Robert Kennedy's lineage, and he has the first Zendo in the diocese, the Catholic Diocese of New York. In other words, a Zendo in a church as well as his parish there.
Wow.
And he was telling me that the contemporary Christian theologian Richard Rohr, who I'm a great fan of, Michael was a good scholar, he's always quoting these things, which I love. He said, there's only one real sorrow in the world, and there's only one real joy, and they are the same thing. It was like it took my head off. I just offered that for anybody that wants to chew on that for the next few lifetimes. Isn't that great? The bittersweetness of existence, you know?
Mm.
And they're the same thing.
Mm.
Maybe they're two sides of the same thing. I don't know. You work it out.
Well, you don't always.
It was great. It was a mind breaker. Like, you remember those jaw breakers? This was like you could chew on this until not just your jaw comes off, but your mind comes off. Your head comes off. Jaw mind breaker. Chew on that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, it reminds me of, you know, I think one of the greatest guidances to me was seeing deep into my teacher, who would sometimes talk about the wound of love, and see that there was a disposition in that awakened heart that was totally ecstatic and blissful and happy, completely happy, but also completely unbuffered from all the pain of the world. Just,
well, vulnerability is a great trait, to the extent that you can handle it. you know, heartbreak is heart opening. Open heart surgery is painful, but heart opening.
Well, you
Who was your teacher?
My first teacher, what I was just talking about, was Adi Da.
Uh-huh. We'll talk about outrageous iconoclastic gurus.
Yes.
Here's the, you know, an exemplar.
He takes the cake. But
once he stole my address book. I've never lost my address book in my whole life except that one.
Really?
He stole it from me. Not like he wanted to use it. I guess I was too attached to it. My little black book with all my names and addresses all over the world. Up in about 1990, before the age of email and cell phones and all that electronic records, Palm Pilots,
Blackberries. Right.
My little black address book, he stole it. I visited him in Clear Lake, California. We had lunch together, which for him was like breakfast because he woke up at noon. He stole my address book. I never got it back. Who am I without all my addresses and friends and network and et cetera? What am I going to do? And how am I going to do it? It was great. What a liberation that was. It didn't matter
at
all.
So.
Nothing was lost.
I just want to keep going, but it is that time when I know there are a lot of other people who'd like to ask questions too,
okay.
So I want to invite them to join in with the conversation with us. So if you're listening via the web, please, if you have any thoughts, please type out, try to be fairly concise, a question in the instant teleseminar window starting right now. And if you've called in on the phone, if you dial star 2, that'll raise your hand, and I'll know that you'd like to ask a question. And while you're getting that done, I have a few things I'd like to let you know about. I want to mention that we're presented free of charge because of the generosity of our wonderful sponsors, including New Dimensions Media. Check out New Dimensions to hear some of the leading point writers in the world, such as Alice Walker, Dr. Andrew Weil, Gene Houston, Bill Moyers, David White, and many others, as they address a wide range of topics, including health and healing, science, eco-activism, social change, and spirituality. Do it now, and you'll be glad you did. That's New Dimensions Media at newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. And Maestro Conference. Maestro Conference is a unique voice-based online collaboration platform that integrates the web and your telephone to support large-scale, real-time remote conferences, seminars, and interactive events. Using cutting-edge technology that empowers individual awareness and engagement, Maestro Conference offers a whole new way to engage people and create relationships, combining the ease of passive media with the engagement and excitement of live events. Visit them on the web at maestroconference.com. That's M-A-E-S-T-R-O, maestroconference.com. Also, stay tuned, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about my upcoming interviews later this week. I'll be talking to Hale Dwoskin, author of The Sedona Method. That's this Thursday in a couple of days, and then with Gene Houston this Sunday, November 21st. Then we'll take off Thanksgiving and reconvene on Sunday, November 28th, for an interview with Ram Dass, formerly Richard Alpert, who's just such an amazing, beautiful being who has been a part of the future of spiritual practice now for 40 years, and he'll give us a unique perspective, I think, on everything we're talking about. So let's get down to our questions and answers. Let's see, do we have, let me look. Yeah, here we go. Joe in Fresno says, I was so excited that you said that Surya was going to talk about Buddha Standard Time, but I didn't hear anything about it. Tell us what that is.
Well, I did talk about it, but I have a new book coming out May 25th called Living Buddha Standard Time. It's not time we lack, but focus and awareness, and I mentioned that. about being more totally in the now and many ways to do that and to deal with our time famine today, to deal with distraction and overwhelm, multitasking, interferences, and so forth, and how we can really be more in the flow and of the flow and realize that we have all the time in the world and that, you know, we're connected to the timeless, so that we can practice being there while getting there every step of the way, not just waiting till we get there, being right here while getting there every step of the way. It's my kind of Dzogchen teachings about nowness, nowness awareness, the true Buddha. So, Joe, that's about Buddha Standard Time.
Great. And we can get your book if we want to really get into it.
Yes, and my recent collection of Dharma Talks, Mind is Mightier Than the Sword, the first two chapters are about nowness awareness, the practice of presencing, as I call it, and so forth. Practice
okay, great.
Related to that.
There's another question here that kind of deals with that topic, too. Tom from Toronto asks, Suryadas, are there any aspects of your understanding and worldview and perspective that appear to differ from those expressed by Eckhart Tolle, or would you say that they do differ in some ways?
They differ in some ways, but I'm a big fan of Eckhart Tolle. I've had dinner with him. I love his work. I recommend his books. I just think that the nature of his awakening is very personal. He's not part of a tradition.
Right.
So I think he's a little short on the practices and the diversity of skillful means for different people, that he hasn't had time to develop that the way Buddhists have over or yogis have over thousands of years, different courses for different horses, different spiritual personality types. And also, I don't really know Eckhart Tolle's work inside and out, so I wouldn't want to, you know, compare or criticize, but there are certain differences. But more, I would stress the similarities and the differences and the importance of living in the now, of letting go of the mind, of recognizing that everything is subjective, you can't just trust whatever you think, and so forth, that the now is where the action actually is. And moreover, you could never live anywhere else anyway, so stop deceiving yourselves. And I think Eckhart Tolle is a clarion voice on that subject today. Since we just heard about Baba Ram Dass, formerly Richard Alpert, let's not forget that the power of now is, to some extent, just, you know, this generation's version of Be Here Now, the huge international bestseller of the 1960s that helped introduce Eastern spirituality to the Western world by Baba Ram Dass.
Yeah, and you were a part of that.
Yes, we were
before
at the same ashram.
Time...
We're part of the Das brothers. We were all at the same Maharaj Nim Karoli Baba's ashram in India. Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, the chanter singer, Surya Das, Bhagwan Das, and other Dasses. Dan Goleman, who's known as, I just went out of my head, Larry Brilliant, of the formerly head of the Google Foundation, and others.
Uh-huh.
We were all Dasses. Jagannath Das is Dan Goleman, author of Emotional Wisdom and dozens of other books.
Right.
So we were all there together. It was a very beautiful time in the early 70s. Das means servant or devotee, so we were all instructed that way, let's say. And
right.
Our teacher was a good model of that, of spiritual selfless service, karma yoga, seva, serving God by serving humanity, as they call it in India, seva. Service to the highest by serving the lowest, seva, selfless service.
There were some different emphases in Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now, and Eckhart Tolle's book. I think people it greeted people in a very different cultural moment, in which I think Ram Dass was kind of a thunderbolt, you know, at a time when Eastern spirituality was really big news and people hadn't even heard of it before. And in a way, Eckhart Tolle came through as this very humble and direct and very transmissively clear set of eyes that simply looked through the mind haze and beckoned us to wake up right here, right now. And
yes, Eckhart Tolle is much more of our time. It's very clear and clean, and that's why he's on satellite radio. Ram Dass's book was published at Lama Foundation, a hippie ashram in New Mexico, first as a box with unbound pages. It was very much of the 60s.
Right.
I remember
that box.
It had a record in it. Does anybody remember records made out of wax?
I remember that record.
But they're very much alike also. Eckhart Tolle is like ice, like cold ice, cold and clear. Ram Dass is like hot ice.
Yeah.
Bhakti, devotion.
And so
fiery.
So warm, such a big heart.
Warm heart.
Yeah. Well, here's somebody asking about another teacher. Let's bring that in while we're in the talking about our beloved
world. We sit in the laps of giants, as I like to say.
Dharma bringers, yeah. Gail from North Hills asks, I've learned Tonglen from Pema Chodron, and if you would explain to us something about using Tonglen, exchanging self for others, some additional clarification would really be great.
Sure. First, let me say, Tonglen is an ancient Vajrayana, so-called Tibetan Buddhist practice, Vajrayana practice. It's rather advanced. Some people are scared by it, so let's not take it too lightly. And I don't know how easy it is or how, you know, well we learn it from books or from tapes. If we are instructed by Pema Chodron personally and can ask questions and clarify them, that's probably good. But having said that, Ani Pema Chodron is a wonderful nun and lama teacher and friend of mine. And we're in similar lineage, the Kagyu Nyingma practice lineage. The thing about Tonglen is a lot of people in America have heard about it and practice it a little out of context, like as a healing practice. It's really not for healing other people. It's for healing the split between self and other. It's for healing the inner conflicts between yourself and yourself. It's for healing dualism and separateness, the illusion of separateness. It's for seeing through the notion of separateness or separate self. So we practice Tonglen. Literally, it means sending and taking, or Tonglen, giving and receiving, breathing out and breathing in, and then visualizing, breathing out all the goodness and virtue and joy and power and energy and vitality that we and health that we have, and breathing it out to the other and breathing in all of their negativity, their illness, and so forth, to try to remove it from them or from the world. It doesn't have to be from another person. It could be from the environment. That's where people get scared, because they are not grounded in the first step of Tonglen, where it says rest in the unborn emptiness. And then the second step, where it says regard everything as like a dream or illusion. And then we can start to visualize hoovering up all the pollution and cancer cells and so viruses and so forth of the world, because we're like a human air conditioner. And breathing in is just the play of illusion in our mind anyway. It's just a visualization. And we know that nature mind is empty. So there's a bottomless, groundless ground to absorb it all, like a leach field. If we don't know that, it can be a little tricky. So having said all that, I think it's very useful to revert or reverse our tendency to cling, to pull in always what we desire and want and like, and to push away and have aversion to all that we don't like and consider negative. So we're reversing that tendency by inhaling the negative and breathing out the positive. I hope you see what I'm saying. We reverse or revert that tendency to give in to desire and always pull towards us what we think is positive, and to push away and have aversion and anger towards what we think is negative.
So
and
it's really
moreover, there's a Buddhist saying that we should think about here, and it's rather steep. Again, this is an advanced practice. There are no unequivocally good or bad things. There's only the wanted and the unwanted. And if you don't believe Buddha, if you don't believe Atisha, whose 59 slogans are part of this Tonglen or spiritual refinement mind training process, William Shakespeare said the same thing, and all Westerners subscribe to it. It's not, what did he say? There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So that means everything is more or less subjective. And that's one side of the teaching of shunyata or emptiness, so-called emptiness, and that's a steep cliff to face and to leap to the top of.
Right. So the point there is that it's a practice about standing in radical
in
consciousness and radical freedom.
Yes.
And
fearlessness.
And
inviting in the negative to take it from others, like taking
right.
the burden of others upon you and giving away the opportunities. Sometimes it says take the loss and give the profit. So it becomes something you can actually practice in life.
So,
but put yourself last, as Jesus said.
And therefore, at a certain point of maturity in practice, it's
yes.
a way of standing in that fierce,
yes.
radical place and, in a sense, just doing the yoga to become stronger and stronger
yes.
and freer and freer.
It's a practice of self-emptying, and when you become nothing, you're everything.
Does it change? Is it a practice that heightens the energy, like a practice that intensifies the yoga, or is it perhaps not so much expressed about, you know, like high or low energy?
Yeah, that's why it's called an advanced practice. It's a tantric practice. It's a Mahayana tantra practice, Vajrayana, very intensive, rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm.
You can get burnt by it. Like some people, if they're oversensitive, they don't know how to dissolve it and stand the emptiness. They're afraid. They don't want to inhale all the pollution or cancer. They want to put up a shield and keep the negativity away, as I hear from New Age people, and that's fine. But this is a different kind of practice. It's about reversing the clinging to what you like and aversion for what you don't like, the basis of dualism, the egotistical basis of separateness and dualism, self and other.
So it's important that it not be done in the spirit of a kind of spiritual bypass where you think you don't
right.
care.
Exactly. And also, it's not a self-help program. Buddhism is not a self-help program. According to Buddhism, there's no self and it can't be helped.
Hmm. That's great. Maybe very related to this is a question from Peter in Boston asking, how do I reconcile a compassion for healing with a compassion for evolution? Healing on the one hand, evolution on the other.
I don't see the contradiction. Healing has evolved over the centuries, and also perhaps illness has too. I don't know. I'm not getting the point about resolving that distinction. Some people would say, how can I resolve the distinction between acceptance and wishing to help or make a better world? But that's not what he said. So what's the contradiction or apparent contradiction, Peter, between healing and evolution?
He doesn't really explain that. I think maybe he means it might be, you know, there's a phrase, passion for evolution, that's come up in some of our past discussions. And he may be saying that there's a kind of passion for evolution that's very active and a compassionate healing kind of impulse that's more about harmonizing, you know, maybe having more to do with serenity and passion in a sense.
I see. You mean that evolution is more passionate and healing is more like acceptance or like quiet. Just,
yes, I may be misinterpreting Peter,
yeah.
but that's what I interpret from his question, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the problem with a lot of these things is what we mean by the words we use.
Of course. Here's a question from Dawn in Maui. She asks, I have faith that life will flow and that my path will unfold, but I sometimes feel I'm missing the road signs, that I'm here for a greater purpose, but I'm often struggling to understand what it is. I feel let down in a way as I sit and continue to ask for guidance, but perhaps I'm missing it. How do I know I'm on the right path? Do I need a teacher?
I think just trusting that you're in the flow and your path will unfold is not enough at this point. And maybe you need a teacher or be able to learn more from everything, whatever comes up as the teacher, or to seek harder. You said, I'm starting to feel dissatisfied of just sitting there and trusting or whatever, you know, waiting for
yeah.
things to unfold.
Waiting for an answer.
Maybe you could be more an avid seeker, you know. Seek and you shall find. It's an ancient adage, knock and the door shall be open to you. I think Jesus said it. You know, today I like to say, Google and you shall find. And there are many ways to do so. If you're on Maui, why don't you go and talk to Ram Dass? He's available. He's semi-retired. He's a great teacher. He speaks English. Get off your butt, girl. I always say this. Pick up your Zafu and walk. Pick up your meditation mat, your yoga mat, and walk. Stop whining, Rav Eddie. Good luck. He's there. You can find him. I think he's in public once a week.
Yeah, I think there are public kirtans
and
celebration sessions.
I think he lives in Haiku. He's findable.
Wonderful. Kevin from Laguna asks, as we co-create a global spirituality going forward, would you please say more about the divine dance along the way?
I think it's all a co-creation, Kevin, you big Bobo. I know you. And Kevin's a dear brother and colleague of mine. And our impetus to create is part of the divine creation, I think, the creator creating through us, if you like to look at it in your own Christian tradition. So the more creative we can be, or the more it can channel through us, you know, it's like artists, they talk about the muse. It may not be really separate from themselves or whatever, but the more it comes through them, the more they clear out their vessel, their channel, the more it comes through them, the more creative they can be as they get out of their own way. And I think that's similar how we can be with the divine creation, as you said, divine dance. And that's co-creation. We're doing it together, God and man, if you like, or us, our lower and higher selves, if you like, or all of us together. And I think that that's what's happening anyway. So we think that we're doing it, but that's part of the illusion. My this, my that, my accomplishments, my history. That's part of the illusion. That's why somebody in your tradition, Kevin, was it St. Paul or Peter? Paul, I think, said, not my life, but thine, O Lord.
Yeah, my will. Not my will, but thine,
O Lord. And I like the life part because it's kind of like not just living out my little life and petty preoccupations, but thine, the greater life, the greater good of all. Heaven on earth, not just waiting for the Messiah to come to usher in the kingdom of heaven. We must be the ushers and show people to their seats in the kingdom. That's co-creation, according to my thought of the moment. Don't hold me to it.
So if you want to raise your hand, please press star 2. And we have a question here from Judy Bullard in Scarborough. How do we remove our egos so as to open up to becoming a bodhisattva? Also, can you say more about how for us to be in our suffering and yet fully, let's see, must be a mistype here. Can you say more for how to be fully in compassion to others' suffering? I guess maybe not to buy your own suffering, but to be fully compassionate to others' suffering.
Well, those two are related. Let me just take on the first one. It's I think, a mistake to think you have to slay or get rid of your ego, as some people say. The ego, you know, having a healthy, individuated adult ego is very important. A Buddhist wise guy, it may have been Jack Engler in Cambridge, Mass., said, you have to become someone before you become no one. You know, it's like you have to become grown up before you transcend the self. And I think it's not about getting rid of your ego. Let's just keep it simple. Let's not get lost in big concepts like emptiness or no self or, you know, getting rid of your ego. How about just being less selfish? And if we could work on the selfishness in our lives, in our minds and hearts, in our relations and our intentions at home and at work and in family, self-interest, as we see it being played out in the world and in politics, if we could work on that, it would be to our all betterment. And then we would feel and connect to the pain in others, as well as the joy in others, and we would feel with them and wish to naturally, altruistically wish to help them, because we feel it too. Or we would also feel their joy and we would rejoice in it, rather than being jealous or covetous. We can draft on their happiness and be pulled along and be happy too. In Buddhism, we have a practice of that called mudita, or sympathetic joy. We rejoice in the virtues, the successes, and benefits of others. And it's a huge antidote to selfishness, to jealousy, and covetousness, and bitterness, as we draft on their happiness. So all of this helps us be less selfish and less egotistical and egocentric. And moreover, if you want to go deeper, you could look into who you are, who am I really, what is the self? You know, is it your body, is it your mind, is it your heart, is it your soul? And see if you're really a separate self, and are you more important than the others or the same as the others? You know, same and different, not same or different. And get into some of these things. It's a practice, self-inquiry. It can be very liberating, very freeing. Bring a lot of self-knowledge and wisdom and good-hearted compassion, too. Less selfish. That's important, I believe.
And working with that begins by acknowledging the selfishness that's there, not pretending
yes.
it's not there.
Yes.
Part of our selfishness is denying our selfishness, isn't it?
Yes, and just like self-hatred, you know, and it is also egotism. It's like, I am worse than anyone. I am the lowest of the low. It's self-inflation. It's self-aggrandizement. Inverted. It's ego run wild. So to acknowledge that and see through our self-deceptions and our limited self-concepts could be very, very freeing. So we can recondition ourselves in better, more positive, intentional, constructive ways rather than destructive, retaliatory, habitual behavior based on fear and selfishness, selfiness and feeling like we're scarcity, coming from scarcity. So much anger and violence is coming from fear and scarcity and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you hang on just a little later than half past the hour? I'd like to give you one more question from
sure.
Janine in Boulder. She has a very interesting question. You mentioned the 64 million mind moments in a second. This reminds me of Edward Muybridge and his pictures of an object in action,
mm-hmm.
where you see individual frames of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum yeah. mechanics suggests because an object can't occupy two places simultaneously, I think she's meaning we can't know the position and the speed of an electron, or
uh-huh.
a bird is only at one place during any given instant of its flight.
Right.
To be in one place, however, is to be at rest.
Yes.
The bird must therefore be at rest at every instant of its flight. How does this relate to being in the moment and in the now?
That's why a Buddhist would understand that everything is already perfectly at rest. Because we're running the projector, it seems like a movie.
Mm.
But each frame is at rest. Just like a rosary looks like a necklace or a noose or a continuous string, but cut the string, it's just a bead, bead, bead. The beads are not connected or stuck together. And similarly, if we're in that much in the moment, we can be, for that moment, free of past and future conditioning. It might be the ultimate therapy to be that much in the moment. Then there's no you. Ourselves, our self-construct. So much of our identity is a matter of memory. All these, the story strung together. In the moment, there's no such string. So we can be free of all that in the moment. Of course, it might come back through habit. Just like a calendar that's been rolled up all year won't hang flat on the wall when you hang it up January 2nd. But if you roll it the other way, it might. So reconditioning and deconditioning practices could be employed. But it's still just the flat paper, whether it's rolled up or not. Don't forget that. So, from the Buddhist point of view, everything is perfectly at rest already. And they say, I wasn't there, but they say the Buddha said there is nirvanic peace and things left just as they are. So that's where a lot of the teachings about letting go and non-attachment and non-manipulation come from. that ultimate utter stillness in the moment, that everything is perfectly at rest where it is. And there's a dynamism to that too, but it's kind of the mystery of stillness. It's the still axis at the center of the wheel, turning wheel.
That's beautiful.
That's the still axis at the center of the turning wheel of this universe, of this cosmos, this mandala.
Mm-hmm. Always in that stillness, even as we...
Yeah, and that's why people talk about God as being timeless or eternal or nirvana. You know, Buddhists will say day and night and bow and nod when you say everything is impermanent, but Buddha didn't say that. He said all conditioned, fabricated things are impermanent. He said that space is not... He gave other examples. Space is not impermanent. Nirvana is not impermanent because they're not put together. It's an inherent quality.
Mm.
Already, always already, as is, to quote the great Ken Wilber, always already.
Yeah. Hey, who was quoting Adi Da?
Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Adi Da was probably quoting somebody before him.
Maybe.
In a long line of plagiarists.
Exactly.
And lineage masters.
We sit in the laps of giants and steal their lines.
And pick their pockets for their notes.
Or their address books.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really a joy. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for everybody for participating and being there together.
We're kind of getting to the end point of our session, but I want to tell everybody what's coming up next week and open up the phone line so we can hear at least some of our voices. I'd like to remind you that I blog regularly at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. A lot of people have commented on one of my recent entries, and you're invited to go there. That's beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. And also, we have a Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, where you can also discuss things or post comments about our dialogue today or suggestions and questions for upcoming dialogues. And if anybody you know is perhaps interested in the series, please invite them to join us and register at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested to know more about me and my work, my website is integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank a couple more partners and sponsors who helped make this possible. Ray Lynch Productions, those of you who've asked about the hold music we play just before the call begins, it's a piece called Only an Enjoyment from the album by Ray Lynch entitled Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening Sky. His album Deep Breakfast went platinum without him even performing or touring, just based on the depth and beauty of the timeless sounds. And you can purchase that music at raylynch.com or via iTunes. That's raylynch.com. And Bay Area Integral, which works to create a vibrant, thriving community of integral practitioners in the San Francisco Bay Area. The purpose is to pioneer the playground where integral culture evolves. And if you're in the greater San Francisco Bay Area, you'll want to visit bayareaintegral.com to get on the mailing list. Also, Bay Area Integral will be hosting its first annual God in Everybody, All Quadrant, Pre-Trans Gala Christmas Party on December 8th of this year.
Now you're talking. A party.
Yeah, that's right. We got a party. And please tune in on Thursday, November 18th, in just a couple of days at 5 p.m. I'll be speaking with Hale Dwoskin, the author of The Sedona Method on Letting Go and Beyond. For 30 years, Hale has trained people in simple, easily learnable techniques that enable them to welcome the flow of life experience and let go of resistance, relaxing their tendency to contract and take things personally, and noticing the spacious unity that's always here when they simply release. And then on Sunday, November 21st, also at 5 p.m., I'll be talking with a researcher, visionary, and force of nature named Dr. Jean Houston on a new order of spirituality in our time. And a week later, on Sunday after Thanksgiving, I'll be joined by Ram Dass on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the publication of his historical book, Be Here Now. So thank you, everybody. Let's open up the phone lines and say goodbye. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.